Everyone, welcome to our new course. This course gives you credits not only for legal, but it gives you credit for psychological, emotional, mental, everything you need, you get credits here. And the uniqueness of this course is not only going to help us understand the Jewish way of law, but give us a whole different understanding in legal cases when we actually deal with the legal, the whole table is yours, with legal law. I think that tonight our goal will be that you will walk out from this course of what is the different motive between civil law versus Jewish law. What motivates Jewish law and what motivates civil law? That you'll walk out. Plus, you will walk out with four actual cases of law in our modern society dealing with Wi-Fi and so on, how we legally, according to Jewish law, may or may not do what people do in today's society. So it's not just going to give you the view of the Torah law, it's also going to give you practicality in our modern age, how we could use it. Obviously, just one important thing, everyone could hear me, right? One important thing is there is a law in Torah that when it comes to civil law and there's a local established government, we need to follow the civil law, meaning we can't say we want to dispute it, but if the civil law conflicts with the Jewish law, so obviously we follow the Jewish law, but more than that, we're not going to walk out with here to say to you, let's not follow the secular law. But we want to give you at least the view so you'll be able to understand how to apply it in your secular law. So let's start first with the United States of America. Why do I call the United States of America a very civil country? Because in the last 200 years, 1776, 1778, whenever the United States was founded, it was really the first democracy of a civilization deciding on a bylaws and a way of the law system should be. Before that, it was the king, you know, made his laws. Obviously, some followed a little the Torah, but kings did, you know what kings, they did whatever they wanted, they did, they didn't want to do, they gave the law to you and they didn't follow the law, you know. Here, at least in the society we're living in, there is a concept of civil law that is supposed to be followed as a law, as a democracy that everyone can follow. It's not, this is the law for you and I do what I want. Everyone, the President of the United States also has to follow the law. It's driven for everyone. So here's two things that I want us to go before we get to the course. Is think about U.S. versus European Union. The U.S., they're very focused on individual freedom. Freedom of speech, freedom of choice. You know, we in the United States of America, the legal system is, what's your rights? The individual. And your rights is your rights. You could take it to as right as you could get. In European, their main focus is equality. Not to take away your individuality, but they want everyone to be equal. In America, we're focusing more on your individual rights. In European countries, they focus more on we're all equal. You know, well, like it's a, that's what communism is a little like. Everyone is equal. Another thing that you see in the United States, freedom of speech. You could get up and you could say a hate speech. You know, I hate America, I hate the government, I hate Trump, whatever you say. You have a right. You could gossip a whole day on the television and you have a right to do what you want. It's your right. The guy doesn't like what I'm saying. I have a freedom of speech. In European country, there's limits. The freedom of speech is not so freedom. I'm not speaking about Russia. In Russia, if you say the wrong thing, you're not alive anymore by mistake. You drank coffee or tea, and somehow you didn't wake up. You know, it wasn't anyone's fault by mistake. I'm not speaking about even in European countries that are pretty much civil. You know, normal, you can't just make hate speeches against the president. It's not like in America. America is the really free of speech. Another difference, and we'll end with this third difference, is providing for funding for private schooling. Like, if you speak to people that live in Europe, Australia, private religious institutions and schooling get funded by the government. In America, it's almost like a fundamental principle that the government should not support any religious or anything that has to do, because we're separating between religion and state. So therefore, they can almost never support, so to say, an institution that's religious or institution that has a religion to it, because we are a country that we are people not connected to anything. You can do what you want. In European, it's not like that. In European, there's very big emphasis, Germany, and in many countries, that they literally support the shul, the rabbi, the school. Everything is paid by the government. At the same time, they're not forcing you to be their religion. You could be any religion. You could be Jewish in Germany, you could be Christian. But they support both. In America, no way. Separation of state and God is very strong. To the point that when they wanted to introduce in the public school system called the moment of silence. I don't know if you remember this. In some states, the local government approved it, but they wanted to make it a federal law that in public school, all the kids, for 1 minute a day, they have to be silent and think of who is the creator. Why are you here? It's called a moment of silence. And there was such a fight in the United States, going forwards and backwards, back and forth. And then they said, I'm sorry, we can't introduce God in a school. Because God is religion. The peoples that wanted to introduce God in the school said, no, God is not a religion. God is a reality, whether you're religious or not. That was the argument. Religion is more kosher, non-kosher, Shabbos, non-Shabbos, you know, worshipping this way, that way. But God is the creator of everyone. Religious, not religious, animals, creatures, fish. That was the argument back and forth. And as of now, it didn't make it a federal law. Every state has a right to decide if we should introduce the moment of silence in their school. So now there's a state that just approved it a few weeks ago, that in their state, the public school, 1 minute a day, all kids stop thinking, and they're thinking about God. Everyone has a choice how to think about God. You want to think God as a Jewish God, you want to think God as a Christian, they don't give you how. Just think 1 minute about God. I'm just giving you this concept. So, the question is, what drives every society that makes their law and their civil law? What is their motivation? So, if you go to text 1, we're going to read the secular law which this was, it's called the Declaration of the Rights of Man, that was drafted by Emmanuel Joseph in year of 1789. It was approved by the National Assembly of France in 1789. It's called the Declaration of the Rights of Man. So let's read text one.
What page?
Page four. Rabbi David. By the way, David is my assistant in this course to help us see what the legal versus the Torah view in the law. So David, please, if you could read it.
Liberty consists in the freedom to do everything which injures no one else. Hence, the exercise of the natural rights of each man has no limits except those which assure to the other members of the society the enjoyment of the same rights. These limits can only be determined by law. Law can only prohibit such actions as are hurtful to society. Nothing may be prevented which is not forbidden by law, and no one may be forced to do anything not provided for by law.
Okay. So in the regular law, how does it work? In regular law, you have a right to do what you want as long as it's not going to hurt someone else's rights. As the famous saying is, your liberty to swing your fist, your liberty to swing your fist ends where the nose of someone else begins. That means you could swing your fist as long as you don't get to the guy's nose. You don't hurt them. So your right in the society right, even in the U.S. Declaration, is you have a right to do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting the other one's rights. Now, let's go for a minute to Jewish law. The Jewish law that we're going to discuss in this course is not laws that have to do between us and God. We're not going to discuss here Shabbos, kosher, tefillin, mezuzah. That's not this law. This is going to be civil Jewish law. Criminal, you know, theft, crimes that we do one to another. So the question is, why is it that Torah gives us civil law? I understand why Torah gives us religious law. Because without Torah, why should I eat kosher? Without Torah, why should I keep Shabbos? But civil law, why is Torah mixing into civil law? Civil law is what people get together and they decide what the law should be. Don't steal. Don't kill. Don't hurt one another. Be honest in business. Why did the Torah take the liberty to introduce civil law and make a civil law system in Torah? To the point that the first thing God taught us on Mount Sinai was all the laws of civil law. Damaging property, people's rights of property, money damage, laundering, all kinds of... That was the first laws that Moshe introduced us. Why is God, Torah, mixing into that? So he says in text 2, he quotes from Rabbi the Barbanel. Text 2, David.
Every human society requires laws. What is the advantage of God's Torah laws over the legal system set up by other nations? Why does the verse state that these are the laws we shall set before them, thereby telling us that these laws are a unique divine system exclusively given to us by Hashem? The reason for this is that the divine laws contain elements absent from other legal systems. God's laws are based on the principles of compassion and goodness.
You hear what he's saying? God's laws is based on compassion and goodness, which we'll soon explain. But for 1 minute, I want to ask you all, are you guys familiar with sports a little or no?
Yeah.
I'm saying you have a familiar. In a sport, in a team of sports, you have a referee, and you also have a coach. I don't know how you say it in Hebrew, but there's a referee and a coach. What is the difference, the different goals of a referee versus a coach?
Coach helps one of the teams, and he's part of the team. But a referee has to enforce the rules for the whole game.
Okay. A referee is not coaching a team. He's just monitoring, monitoring that the game is done right for everyone. So if someone hits someone, you know, when during they pass the ball and they kick someone, whatever, so he makes sure this guy's out of the game. So he's not coaching a certain team. He's just maintaining that the game be done the right way. You follow what I'm saying? So like, he's just making sure that you follow the laws of this game.
He's calling me the judge.
Huh?
He's like the judge of a jury. He's the judge of the game.
But he's not taking a team. He's not encouraging you winning or not winning. It's not his. It's not his department.
He has to be impartial.
Right. You want to lose, you want to win, doesn't make a difference to me. You want to hit the ball, you want to not, doesn't make a difference to me. What I have to do is just to make sure everything is maintained right. The coach is just a whole different approach. He has to come to the team, and he's coaching them not just to maintain and do the right thing. He's coaching them to win. He's helping them to be not just don't hurt the other, but you got to win this game. It's a big difference between a referee and a coach, right? So now, let's go to text 3. Text 3, go. On page 6. You have it? Page 6, read.
Diligently observe God's commandments that He has commanded you. Do what is right and good in God's eyes.
So basically, it's the difference between Jewish law and secular law is the secular law is like a referee, just maintaining right your rights, as long as it doesn't hurt the other one's rights. In Jewish civil law, it's like a coach. It's not just maintaining rights, it's doing what is right. I'm going to coach you to do the right thing. In the secular law, it's like a referee. I just have to maintain that whatever you want to do, you don't hurt someone else. And you try to follow the law. In the Jewish civil law, it's maintaining you to say no. I'm going to shape you, and I'm going to make you do it the right way, because I want you to succeed and not only not hurt others, or not only I want you to be good. See the difference? So the Jewish secular law, Jewish civil law is like a coach. I'm going to shape you. I'm going to make you in the right way how you should act in civil law. In the secular civil law, it's more a referee, just maintaining order. But I don't care what you do, you could jump on the roof, you know, as long as you're not hurting anyone else, you could do what you want. In Jewish law, it doesn't work, yeah?
Rabbi Manhattan once told me that, his name was Rabbi Buchholder, and he once said to me, in secular law, it's innocent until proven guilty, but in Jewish law, it's guilty until proven innocent. And what that means is that, whereas here, well, the secular law, you know, we're trying to prove you guilty, so you're innocent, but you're trying to be found guilty. But the Jewish law is the other way around. You're guilty, but you're trying to be proven innocent.
Okay.
Is that the word?
So that sounds like a good. Basically, in Jewish law, you're responsible for everything till it's proven that you're not. In secular law, you're not responsible for anything till it's proven that you are.
Yeah.
Okay. So look what he says, and end off this concept in text 4. There are two types of laws. Laws that create life, and laws created by life. Human laws are created by life. God's Torah is divine law, and it creates the life. So what's the difference? There's nowhere in secular society that every person has to study all the laws in secular society. Who knows the laws of secular society? The lawyers. So if you have a question about a law, you're going to call a lawyer. Okay, what? And the lawyer says, is it good, not good? You know, and every law lawyer is a professional, different field. In Jewish law, everyone tries to learn all the Jewish law. What are you doing in yeshiva? You're learning the whole Talmud, which discusses all the law. Why? Because by Jewish law, civil law, it makes the society. In the secular civil law, it's created by the society. So for us, we want to know what makes the society. How are we going to make it a better place? How are we going to introduce the goodness? So we are learning, everyone is learning all the law in Talmud because we want to know what's going on. How do I make and shape this society to a good way? In the secular law, I don't care about law. If I have a question, I call a lawyer and I hire him to do the law. Who needs law? As long as I'm not hurting you and I'm not going against anyone else, I don't need a law. In the Jewish society, law is what shapes our life. It makes our life. It creates our life. It creates our goodness. So I want to know what that is. So I have to learn it. So you understand this concept? Now here's an interesting thing. We're going to bring you four cases of modern law that happened, stories that happened, and we're going to discuss how the secular law looks at it and how the Jewish law is. The first study is on page 8, case study A. We're going to call it A on page 8. Hold on one second. This is a very interesting story. It happened in California in 1870. Read the story. Someone wants to read to us? Dave, you want to read it?
Nicholas Young considered himself a lucky man. A German who immigrated to the United States in 1848, Young had worked hard to carve out a living for himself and eventually prosper as the owner of a mortuary in San Francisco. The business allowed him and wife Rosina to purchase a modest lot on the top of California Street Hill, where they built a quaint cottage-style home and planted a beautiful garden. Every day, California sunlight and fresh air would stream in through their windows. Young had no reason to believe that anything could interrupt his idyllic life, or that any one person could somehow deprive him of the beautiful days he had worked so hard to enjoy. But Young also hadn't accounted for Charles Crocker, a very rich and very petty man, who would eventually become both his neighbor and the bane of his existence. At 6 feet tall and 300 pounds, Charles Crocker cut an imposing figure. He had filled his bank account by being one of the big four barons behind the building of the Central Pacific Railroad. By the 1870s, he could afford whatever he desired, and what he wanted was to loom over San Francisco like a gargoyle. Crocker and his wealthy partners began scouting California Street Hill for its scenic views and proximity to the city's financial district. Soon a group of wealthy men, including Crocker, were buying up all the homes on their chosen blocks. By the time Crocker was finished, he had erected a 12,000 square foot mansion. With its new wealthy inhabitants, California Street Hill was renamed Knob Hill. As the project neared completion in 1876, there was one nagging detail. On the northeast corner of the block, Nicholas Young was reluctant to sell. His cottage was dwarfed by the mansions going up, but he had come to enjoy the neighborhood. With one or both men causing acrimony, the end result was that Young was not moving. At a reported cost of $3,000, Crocker had his workers construct a wooden fence on his land that towered over three sides of Young's home. With its 40-foot tall panels, the enclosure acted like a window shade, blotting out the sun and cool air and immersing Young in darkness.
So what he did was, you understand, he...
Spite fence.
What is it called?
Spite fence.
Spite fence. He built a fence on his property, not on the other one, 40 feet tall, and it was on three sides surrounding this other little property. So now this guy has no sun, no air, nothing, and it's his property. Does he have a right to do it? And if he did it, does do you make him remove it? What's the law?
There's a law like in each town.
What's the law?
All the houses are the same level.
Other level fence, you can't make it
higher.
Okay, that's a law, and you mean zoning law.
Fine, yeah.
Uh-huh. This was in California. This is in 1870. They didn't maybe have that law. So the question is, if I have a right to do what I want on my property, but by doing my right of what I want on my property, someone else is not going to have the sun and not going to have the wind and not going to have fresh air, is what do I do? What's the law in the secular and what's the law in the Jewish? So that's case number one. We're going to get to, the lawyers will soon tell us. So should Charles Krakas fence be legally allowed to stand? That's the question, okay? Do you have a picture in your book or no?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a picture.
You have a picture? Turn the page.
Yes.
This is an actual picture. You could see the mansion of Charles Crocker, and then you see the spite fence, this big fence, 40 feet tall, that he built three around the property. Okay, anyways, you could see the picture. So that's case number one. Case number two. Read case number two.
Case study B. Rachel maintains a large and beautiful flower bed in her yard. But one day her neighbor Joe built a high wind fence between their properties that cast shade over the garden, causing the flowers to die. When Rachel asked Joe why his fence needed to be so high, she was told that it was necessary to protect his birds from cats entering the property. Rachel offered to replace the wind fence with a glass screen at her personal expense in order to allow her flowers to receive sunlight without exposing Joe's birds to danger. But Joe refused to allow Rachel to replace the fence without offering any reason.
Okay, this is more of a pretty normal situation. He built a fence. He doesn't say he made a despite fence. Despite fence means I'm building a fence just to hurt you. That was the first case. This case, no. He built a fence because he didn't want the birds,
the cats to come
eat his birds. Okay, so that's not a fence I'm building to hurt you. I'm building a fence because I don't want cats to eat my birds. But the neighbor said, my flowers died because the sunshine is not going through. Can I pay to replace your fence with a glass fence so you'll be protected that the cats won't eat the birds and I'll at least have sunlight? And the neighbor says, I don't want to. What's the law? Should Joe be legally required to allow Rachel to replace his wooden fence with a glass screen? Should we make Joe have to replace that fence? What do you think?
Replace, of course. Yeah.
You know, but he doesn't want to. He didn't build a fence to hurt you. He built a fence for his protection. You don't like my wooden fence because your flowers are dying because of the sun? That's not my issue. She said, I'll pay. I don't want you to change it. Do we make him change it? In the secular law, what would you do?
It goes against what we read in the Declaration of the Rights of Man. It says, liberty consists in the freedom to do everything which injures no one else. But both the spite fence and the fence for the cats injures the other party.
No, here I agree.
They damage, that, no hurt.
So I'm saying
you're saying that the wooden fence replacing with the glass would...
No, I'm saying it should be replaceable by the glass fence because his wooden fence is hurting this woman's
the flowers. Okay, right. What are you saying?
I mean, under secular law, New York or probably California law either, case study B is a pretty easy case. Joe doesn't have to do anything that he doesn't want to. It's his property. There's no argument that he's creating a public nuisance by putting up a high wind fence. There probably aren't any zoning regulations that prohibit him from doing that, and he's not required to accommodate Rachel just because it would be more convenient or aesthetically pleasing for him to have a glass screen rather than a wooden fence.
Okay, it makes sense, right? And secular law makes sense like that, right?
Yeah.
Why should...
His choice.
His choice. The fact that Rachel wants to pay me and replace the fence, I don't have to. I didn't build... You see, in the first case... He just built a fence to hurt the person. Okay, there we could think about, it's called a spite fence. They have in some states a law that if you build a fence just to hurt the other, that's like, you know, because there's no purpose for you. But here, he's really got the fence for himself. He doesn't have to change. So that's what David told us. That's the secular law. What do you say, Norman?
Yeah, well, there's more to it, because that spike fence could also be a diminishing value. By having a fence that tall, you're diminishing the value of the property next door, because they don't have sun, they don't have light, and therefore the property value would have to go down, because they don't have access to the beach.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
On the other hand, you have the same, probably the same.
That's
thing,
strong. That's a strong point.
Strong, because of the fact that the glass could be injurious. The guy could claim that the glass could be like a magnifying glass and cause harm to the birds also.
Beautiful. Excellent. Now let's go case study C. Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi. You know what Wi-Fi is? Anyone know what Wi-Fi is today? Okay, go.
Michael moved into a new house. Before setting up his own Wi-Fi connection, he realized that his neighbors have an open Wi-Fi network.
Can Michael use his neighbor's Wi-Fi network without their knowledge?
That's a no-brainer. He can't.
He can? Or he can't?
Without knowledge. He can't.
He can't? That's the law?
It's the law. He's stealing if he does.
Why? Why? Tell me why is he stealing?
Password. What?
It's open.
It's open, but isn't it stealing though?
I'm asking, what is he stealing? What was the theft that he's taking away? What? The neighbor has Wi-Fi.
The speed.
Oh, it's slowing down.
Yeah.
So the neighbor is out of town. Could he use it when the neighbor is out of town?
If it's open, I guess maybe.
I'm asking you. I'm just asking what the secular law is.
Close the window. Say they're always out of town.
It's not your property.
So the Wi-Fi you're saying is owned by you. You own the right to that Wi-Fi, and therefore he's like.
You pay for it.
You pay.
And the neighbor is also getting it, and you.
It's free. I don't think that's. I think that's stealing.
Okay, what do you say, David? What's the secular law about Wi-Fi?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure what the law is on the subject. It usually doesn't come up because usually your Wi-Fi is password protected, so other people can't get onto it without your consent. I've never actually seen a court case where somebody sued because somebody else was using their Wi-Fi without their permission.
The lawyer costs more than the bill of the Wi-Fi.
No, but the funny thing is, that in our teens, our young kids, they know how to go through every password and they connect to every Wi-Fi. You know what I'm saying? What does password mean?
I wouldn't even know if somebody
can. Yeah, how do you know? You wouldn't even realize. You only know the speed is slow.
Right.
Well, isn't it comfortable to somebody, like in a rental building where there are several apartments, if somebody starts using your electricity, they change the meter so that they can get your electricity in their apartment, but you're paying for it. So it seems comparable to somebody using your Wi-Fi.
Still,
and that is highly against the law, and they can be greatly fined.
But I think the difference maybe, I don't know, the difference maybe is by electricity, you're taking energy and you're using it. And Wi-Fi, you're not diminishing the other person's energy. He still gets the Wi-Fi anyway.
It slows down.
Maybe. I don't know. Today, Wi-Fi,
paying a higher bill,
with all the extra Wi-Fi, whatever they have, nothing slows down.
Electricity you bill by used.
Yeah, so
Wi-Fi is monthly.
Wi-Fi is the same rate.
The using doesn't make it cost more. And also, there's no more. If you use Wi-Fi more?
No, I'm saying with electricity, you.
Yeah, electricity, but Wi-Fi, you don't pay more for using it more. Mm-hmm. So you're not stealing.
Well, he said it reduces the speed.
So maybe. Okay. I don't know.
But you can't prove it.
How do you know?
Well, that's what he said. So
I don't know. I'm saying we're not sure. So it could be, yeah, it could be not. You know, a lot of times you have your own Wi-Fi and the office is slow. Because the weather is bad outside. Nothing to do with that. Okay, the last case, D. Sarah's next door.
Sarah's next door neighbor, David, left on a lengthy vacation. Sarah's next door neighbor, David, left on a lengthy vacation. It's difficult to find parking on their street, and David's driveway, situated smack in between their two homes, is now empty. Sarah wishes to park her car there while her neighbor is away.
What do you say?
Not legally, she needs permission.
What is the neighbor going to lose?
Wear and tear on the driveway.
Yeah, it's trespassing, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's trespassing. So you say it's illegal?
Illegal.
So let's say it's illegal.
Permission.
So let's say she did it. Does she have to pay rent?
She should.
Let's say she did it without permission. Let's say you went away for a month vacation and her car was there for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. You come back and everyone says, did you have a car in your driveway? No. And you find out it's Sarah. So does she have to pay? I see. Is she allowed to do it without asking permission?
No.
Not technically, no.
No, right? What's in the second law?
No, she clearly is not allowed to park there without his permission. It's criminal trespass, and in some states it would be civil trespass, too.
Oh, yeah?
So she would have to.
Well, in theory, she could be held criminally liable. That is prosecuted, and in some states, she might have to pay monetary damages as well.
If there was, you mean? If there were.
If there were.
She gets it to court. Damages.
Because what if someone does happen and the car like caves in on the driveway, you know? It could cause physical damage.
Yeah. Okay, you're right. It could be. Yeah. Okay. So this is the four cases. So what we're going to do now, we're going to show you what the Torah's civil law would say about these cases, and I know it conflicts with what we said, but I just want you to understand the Torah's view, why they hold different than these cases. That's it. And at least you'll walk out understanding the Torah's view on civil law. So, before we do that, just one thing about Torah law. Oh, where's the video? No. Okay. We'll get it later. Number one, do not stand when someone's life is at risk. Is there any law in secular law that you are obligated to help someone's if their life is at risk? So let's say you're walking on the street and someone is bleeding. Are you obligated by law to help them? Or it's a good thing you should do, but if you don't, are they going to press charges on you?
Well, no, unless you were the one who created the danger in the first place.
But if I'm just walking by.
No, if you're just walking by.
You're not obligated to be a good Samaritan, right?
Huh?
You're not obligated to be a good Samaritan.
Right. So according to secular, right?
Right.
But according to Jewish law, the Torah says in Leviticus, Lo Samoid al Damriach. You cannot go by and you see someone is hurt and just say, it's not my business, you could bleed and I'll worry about it, you know. You gotta do something, and you gotta take action, and do whatever you need to help this person. Number two, pick up a lost object you encounter and return it to its owner. So you're walking on the street, you see on the floor a computer, a laptop. You don't know whose it is. Do I have to pick it up? On the street, I'm walking on Central Avenue. I see a laptop on the street. Do I have to pick it up in civil law and go find the owner? No, I could lay there and let it rust and let it. In Torah law, you are obligated to pick it up and try to get the owner. If you don't find the owner, you have to keep it in a safe place in your house, take care of it, and make sure that it's in a good, safe position. So you have an obligation to pick up the lost object. You hear this? Next, provide roadside assistance. You hear this? You're driving with a car, and on the side, someone is stuck. No, really stuck. I don't mean someone that's faking a game, but really stuck. The car broke, the flat tire, whatever it is. Do I have to stop and assist them, or just let them call AAA or call the police?
Only if they have the amateur.
So, the Torah says you are obligated to provide road assistance. You can't just drive by. If one condition I just want to say, if you feel there's a threat to you, that's something else. If you're not sure, you know, if you think this might be.
If you live in Israel.
I'm saying if you think it's a threat to you, then. That's not what we're talking about. We know that you see someone is stuck, the car's broken, whatever. You know this is an honest thing. You have an obligation to go out of your car, help them, take off the load, help the situation, fix the car, bring them to the situation, and get them on back onto the road.
But unless they have a gun, right?
Yeah, yeah. As long as it's not jeopardizing your
life.
The last thing is, don't spread gossip. Is there a law in civil law that you can't say gossip?
No.
Open up any news station. Gossip. Could you?
I mean, the exception is that if it's false, you could be held liable for defamation. But you can always say things that are true.
Oh, you could say true?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you can do defamation, slander, right.
But you could say the truth?
Yes.
Yeah. Even if
so you have a right to say a truth about someone that's bad.
Yeah, even if it's disparaging.
Right?
Yeah.
But in the Torah law, you know what a crime it is to say gossip? It's like 36 crimes. It's the worst thing. So why is it? This is, and by the way, all of this is civil things. A lost object. All these things are not religious. This is just civil things. Why is it that the Torah makes us pick up the lost object, try to return it to the owner? Why does the Torah make us not say gossip? Why does the Torah make us not stand when someone is bleeding? What's going on here? What's the motive here?
Make it a better place.
Oh, so the point here is, this is a very important point, that our civil Jewish law is a law that's making the situation, and we got to take action to do good things. We can't just maintain, like a referee, maintain the game. We're here in this world to coach and make it a good team, and make it a good game, and make it a good life, and make it a good society. We have an obligation. We're coaches. We're not referees.
Rabbi, I think Europe has it on us, you know.
Huh?
Because here in the U.S. we've missed the boat because we all focus on like civil, regular civil law. Whereas in Europe, they have it both ways.
They have it both ways?
You said the coach and referee.
Oh, okay.
Not just referee.
So in Torah, there's a big emphasis in being the coach. So, what is that going to change? So, it's called, all these laws that I just told you, there's a lot like this, but there's so many laws in the Torah that is almost making you do something. You can't sit idle. I'll give you an example. If someone is sick, is there any civil law in the secular law that you have to go visit the sick and try to help them? There's no, you don't have to go visit the sick. There's no, as long as you don't make them sick. The Torah says, no, you got to go visit the sick. What's going on? Because Torah is not a referee. It's a coach. There's no such a thing in Torah, live and let live. You got to make it good. It's a major difference. I'll give you a practical example. Let's go to skip text 5. Let's go to text 6. You ready for text 6? It's on page 15. Yeah, read.
A person is compelled by law not to act in a manner characteristic of the inhabitants of Sodom.
There was a city in Israel called Sodom. What was wrong with that city? What did they do wrong there? What did they do wrong in Sodom? So, look, huh?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
You ever read in the Chumash? Right? So look what the Pirkei Avos, chapter 5, says, what is Sodom? Look in text 7a. 7a on page 16. Look what it says.
One who insists what is mine and what is yours is of average character. However, another opinion maintains that such an attitude is characteristic of the wicked people of Sodom.
Okay, listen to what happens. If I say mine is mine and yours is yours, one opinion says that's average. Mine is mine and yours is yours. I'm not taking from you. You don't take from me, I don't take from you. Mine is mine, yours is yours. The second opinion says no. If you say mine is mine and yours is yours, that's Sodom. That's like criminal. It's so first is how do you have two extreme opinions about the same thing? Mine is mine and yours is yours. One says it's good, it's average. And the other one says it's the criminal of criminals, Sodom. Sodom was destroyed by God. So how do you have two extremes? Number two, what's wrong with saying mine is mine and yours is yours? What's going on here? So here is the important civil foundation of Jewish civil law. This is based on this. What's the foundation? If there's something that someone else could benefit and it doesn't take away anything from you, which we'll soon show you a cases like that, we force you to let the other one benefit if it doesn't hurt you. What was Sodom? Sodom was that they didn't lose, but they didn't want you to benefit. Mine is mine, and yours is yours. And they didn't, even though there was no loss to them, but you can't have anything of any benefit from mine, even though there's no loss to me. So if there's any case, as I will soon show you the case, where you have no loss by the other one benefiting from you, so what's wrong with him benefiting from you? What are you losing?
The parking lot.
The parking lot is a good example. If you don't damage the parking, what are you losing by the car being there? What did you lose? If it didn't damage the property, if everything was good. What did you lose by the guy keeping his car when you were away on vacation for a month and he didn't damage anything? The parking lot was great. No, what did you lose?
No harm, no foul.
Huh?
No harm, no foul.
Right? In this case, we're going to say to you, not only they don't have to pay anything, but you should let them. We'll soon get to about trespassing. I know everyone is about trespassing, but what did he lose? But in a case where if you help someone else, it's going to damage you a little. You know, you're going to lose some money. You're going to lose. So then we don't force you to do it. If you want to, good. If you don't want to, so therefore, the Mishnah is divided in two. If by the other one benefiting, you're going to lose, then you don't have to. But if you're not going to lose anything by the other one benefiting, that's Sodom, if you don't do it. So let's read text 7b. Read text 7b.
Both statements in the Mishnah are valid because the second view, which classifies such conduct as wicked, refers to those who refuse to permit others to benefit from them, even when they will incur no personal or monetary expense as a result. Such conduct is characteristic of the inhabitants of Sodom. By contrast, the first view in the Mishnah, which classifies such conduct as average, refers to those who refuse to allow others to benefit from them when doing so would come at a personal or monetary expense. Individuals who adopt this approach cannot be compared to the inhabitants of Sodom because they seek simply to avoid incurring losses through the actions of others, just as they would not inflict a loss upon their fellow. This indeed reflects the average character.
Got it? So what's a practical example? This happens so much in this society. You're living in a house. You have a beautiful windows, you know, on the second floor. Everything is nice. And all of a sudden, a guy builds a house next door, you know, and it blocks all your windows. Not even if he's a few feet away, it's still... So the guy that's building the new house comes to you and says, I know that because of my house, I'm blocking your windows. You know what I want to do? I want to pay, I'm going to hire workers and change your windows. Instead of being low, I'll bring it higher so you'll still have the sunlight. You following? In other words, I'm building a house, and I know that by me building the house, it's going to block the lights of your windows of the first floor. I have people that can make the windows a little higher without damaging you. You don't have to leave the house. You'll be able to sleep at night and just make it into a higher. So like this here. And the guy says, you know what? I don't want you to change my windows. Don't build the house. You get what I'm saying? Because he doesn't want to bother with it. So look in text 8. You understand? Look in text 8, what the Torah says, text 8.
A person has windows set in the lower portion of the wall of his house, and his neighbor desires to erect a building that would block them. The neighbor proposes to solve the problem by installing new windows in the upper portion of the homeowner's wall. If this arrangement won't cause the homeowner any difficulty at all, and would not require him to leave his home during the construction, he cannot prevent the new neighbor from performing this construction. The homeowner is compelled by law to allow the neighbor to close the windows on the bottom part of his wall and create new windows higher up. This is because it would be Sodom-like conduct for the homeowner to refuse this accommodation. This principle applies to every situation in which one individual will benefit while his fellow will not lose anything as a result. In all such cases, the relevant party is compelled by law to cooperate.
Yeah, that's not what's going on here? So in other words, if your neighbor that's building the house is coming to you and saying to you, I'm going to change the windows, and I'm going to build it in a way that it's not going to damage your house, and you can still live in your house, and you know everything is good, and you say, I'm not interested, so then you have a choice. Either you let him put the windows higher, or he could build his house without blocking your windows, because this is called Sodom. Sodom means you're going to benefit, you're going to have a nice house, but I'm not going to hurt you because I'm ready to change the windows. So why are you being so stubborn and not letting me change your windows and making everything work? So we go against your will and we say, listen, if you're not going to do it, then I'm going to just build my house and block your light. I'm ready to do it. You can't stop me from building this house because it blocks your light, because I was ready to help you and make everything, and you're not going to lose.
And for me, two more floors.
Huh?
Two more floors. Why windows?
I'll tell you. I'll put two more floors. Whatever you want.
Also, it's not like the equivalent of greed, you know. I just want to keep it all for myself, you know. I don't want to help you, even if it does hurt. I don't want to help you. It won't hurt you, but I'm going to keep it all for myself because I don't want your benefit.
Exactly.
You're being greedy, right?
So, yeah. What do you say, Norman?
You're talking about, now they're talking about Jewish law, not secular law.
Right.
Because secular law is obvious. The guy already has a building permit. So his building permit is already excluding the guy who's already existing. So there's no need for the individual to come over and say, I'm going to be nice and build your windows higher. He doesn't come to him for a variance. He's coming to him because he already got the building permit.
I understand. But
no,
that's...
but it's important.
But that's okay.
Jewish law, he's doing it out of kindness. But at the same time, he may need the guy who's got the house existing to give him a permission so he can have a variance so he can build the house.
So now let's go back.
The bottom line is that all of this falls under one rubric, and that is, v'ahavta l'rayacha kamocha.
Okay.
You gotta love your neighbor, otherwise you can't be part of this continuum.
Okay, so now let's go back to case here. Let's go back. You can go ahead. To the two first cases, A and B. Remember A and B? One was the guy in California built this huge 40-foot wall. We call it this spite fence. And what was the second one? What was B?
The mirror. The window. Flower.
The glass. The flower. So now after learning this, the one in California that built this huge wall to despite his neighbor, and there's no benefit, you understand? He just did it. Yes, that's Sodom. What would we make him do?
Tear it down.
We would make him tear it down. Why? There's nothing, there was no benefit for you. Mm-hmm. And what is he, what are you doing here? You're hurting the other person with
it.
What are you doing? It's and by the way, I think you said it before, there is such a law in some states, the spite wall, right?
Yeah.
That you have to take it down?
There are some states where you probably would have to, yeah.
Yeah, take it down?
Yeah. But at common law, no. At common law, you could build the spite fence.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So he says that at common law, you could build this fence just to despite your neighbor. You know, like, I'll make the most ugliest fence, and, you know, and I don't care. It's on my property. I can do what I want. But there are some states, maybe, But in Jewish law, no. But now the second case, what do you say about the second case? What was the second one? She was ready to pay to change the wood fence to the glass. He needed the fence so the cat doesn't eat the birds. So is he going to lose if she changes it to glass?
No.
No. She's going to gain that her flowers are going to grow. So she's gaining, her flowers are growing. He's not losing because he has a fence that is going to protect the cats from eating his birds. So what do? We force against his will that she could change the fence of his property. I know this is not the state law. Because Sodom! Why are you being so mean? You're going to get a beautiful fence, even nicer than the wood. I'm getting a glass fence. And you could tell him, I want a good glass. I want it to last better than the wood. You know, make it good. Don't make it cheap. So you're gaining a fence, while the other one, and you're not losing, while the other one is gaining nice flowers. So if in that case, the other one is gaining nice flowers, and you're not losing a fence because I'm putting you a nice fence, what do you mean you say no? I'm going to compel you to do it, according to Torah, civil law, because it's called Sodom. Because the famous, remember this famous statement throughout the whole thing. Any situation that someone benefits and the other one doesn't lose, we force you to do it because you're benefiting, the other one doesn't lose. Why not?
And if you have a pool and you want privacy, so it's something different.
That's something else, yeah. Oh, because of the glass, you mean?
Yeah.
That's something else, yeah. Here we're seeing what it was for the cats. Yeah, that's it. Okay, so does this make sense what we said till now? We still have the Wi-Fi issue and
the parking.
We'll get to the Wi-Fi and parking in 2 minutes. Yes?
I want to point something out. I know in Torah law this would be clearly Sodom, but maybe a Lord can answer this question for me about civil law. Like, I want you to see the show sometimes called Fear Thy Neighbor. Ever seen that show?
No.
It's about that these neighbors would start out as good friends, but eventually they go after each other. And there was one episode I saw where, the first one I saw actually, where these two neighbors were living in Clearwater, Florida, and one moved across to Michigan. They started out as good friends and stuff, but eventually everything broke loose and that's what changed direction of things. And they started bickering each other by writing billboards and saying, go back to Michigan, they're saying profanities. Are they allowed to do that under civil law?
You're saying they put up billboards
on their property,
to
the other one, go back to Michigan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in practice, there would probably be a zoning law that prohibited that, but at common law, you could put up billboards on your property saying bad but not false things.
Yeah, I don't totally know. That's totally so dumb, but you know.
Yeah.
You could do that. You could put a billboard writing, go back to Germany or whatever.
Go back to Michigan.
Well, like I said, I mean, most neighbors have zoning laws that prohibit you putting any billboards on your own property. But a common law, yeah, I mean, you can put up a billboard that says bad but not false things about
it. Okay. What's your question?
I have a few questions, but I'll start with one. What if there's a conflict between Jewish and civil law? So I'll give some examples. You mentioned if you find a misplaced object and you take it, you should take it home and take care of it. Well, that would be theft.
Yeah, really?
Right, in the U.S. Yeah, I mean, I can't just take something home.
No, you're taking it home to return it to the owner, but you don't know who it is. So you're keeping it until you find the owner.
Yeah, I don't think you...
You're allowed to?
Maybe you take it to the police station, I guess.
Oh, you can't take it home. Okay, I don't know. You see, I want to hear the law. That's why you're here. I don't know.
I mean, generally speaking, in civil law, it's finders, keepers, losers, weepers.
Right.
That is,
right.
You find an object on the street. It may have some value, but there's no easy way to determine who owned it. You have the right to take it home and exercise.
Even if you take it to the police, if they don't find the owner of it, they keep it, or the police officer takes it. So
okay,
you might as well.
Oh yeah, so you could take it.
No, I have it like jewelry.
Oh really?
A piece of jewelry.
Yeah, because you know. Yeah. Okay.
I have another example.
somebody put a complaint.
You see a small child walking in the street alone. They seem really young. You offer them a ride home. You try doing that in Jersey. You're like a drawing of your face will be on the local papers. Like,
oh, because it's like your kid. That you,
So Jewish law would say, oh, you should try. So what then?
She has a good question. She's saying, because if I see a kid walking on the street alone, young kid.
In the rain.
No, could you take them home till you find out who?
No, of course. I know that, but I'm saying that.
Well, you will do good by calling someone with authority to
Take this kid. Okay. So honestly, in this case, you're gonna, even Jewish law will say to you, call the police. In this case, because you're putting yourself in a danger, because they're gonna all say, oh, you abducted a child, and that's the end. So you don't have to hurt yourself by helping someone else. You know what I mean? Because if you're gonna lose, then you don't. If you're not gonna lose, then you have to help. But here, you're gonna lose everything. Yeah. So now, here's an interesting thing. A very strange, true story in the Talmud, which answers the car, with the car and the parking. Look at this, on text 9. No pain, only gain. That's the what happened. Look what happened, text 9. Read, David. It's page 20.
No pain, only gain. If one lives in his fellow's yard without the latter's knowledge, does he have to pay him rent or not? The question is in regard to a yard that is not on the market for rent, but the squatter is a person who usually rents. What is the law? Can the squatter say to the owner, what loss have I caused you? Or perhaps the owner can insist, look, you have benefited from my property instead of paying rent elsewhere. This is a case in which one individual benefits while the other does not lose anything. The Talmud concludes, Rabba the son of Rav Kuna stated, my father ruled in the name of Rav that the squatter does not have to pay rent.
So what happened was a squatter is a guy just on the street, moves into someone's house that was empty.
Without permission.
Without permission, he moves into the house. And so let's say you have two houses. Your house you live in and another house. But that house, you're not renting to anyone. You just own it, but you're not renting it, so you're not making money on it. So a guy from the street moves in, and he's there for a few months. The owner of the house says, pay me rent. The guy says, what do you mean? You never rent the house out. It's not. I didn't make you lose rent, because you don't rent this house. It was an empty house.
He paid taxes.
I understand, but he's paying taxes. You know, if it's a house that you rent to others, and now by this squatter living there, he's taking away your rent, so you could charge him rent. Say, listen, either you pay rent, or I get rent from someone else. But here a guy comes on the street and is living in a house that wasn't made to rent to begin with. And now you're saying to him, pay me the rent. He says, what do you mean? You didn't lose anything. You don't get rent anyway. I'm just living in a house. I didn't damage it. And what, you not losing, I'm gaining. What's the law? It's like Sodom if you don't. And he doesn't have to pay rent. Does that sound civilly right? Yeah, he has to pay for that.
He has to pay
for gas, electricity, he has to pay for. But what does he want to charge him? Gas and electricity that he used, of course he has to pay. But he wants to charge him for rent. You lived in my house. He says, did you rent it to anyone before? Were you planning to rent it? No. So you had an empty house. You didn't rent it to anyone. You weren't planning to rent it. So I'm not making you lose rent because you weren't renting it anyway.
So if you come to his house and you have an empty room, you have the empty room anyway.
So then we're going to get... So what do you say? He shouldn't pay.
Yeah, you can sleep in your room. You're not using it.
Squatters is a big problem in civil law, too. I had a friend who in Long Island who housed across the street, was empty, the woman died. She had no children, no grandchildren. And it's a Jewish era, but bad kids. Just got in and he said, one second, he called the gas company, electricity, they put it on as long as you pay, and they living there. And they were just, bad kids, they hurt the neighborhood, they didn't know how to get rid of them. And by law, they have the right to stay in the house.
So who's going to pay for the
squatter? It's the squatter's law. Like, especially if they've served there for a period of time, nobody's there to remove them. The woman died. It's not my friend.
And there's no one owns it?
No, the owner died. She has no children, no.
The state normally would take it over.
Yeah, but I guess, but it was whole procedure.
No,
you couldn't get, you know, I think eventually they got
the years out, ago on the Lower East Side, there were places on 13th Street and Avenue A, B, C that people had deserted the properties and there were people living in the building.
Yeah.
Then the state or the city made laws that required them to move out because they then, the city becomes, I think it becomes eminent domain and they take it over.
Yeah, right, don't they called the police. The police kept coming on just.
So look, I just want to, so as we learn this, it sounds like I could go into someone's, like he said, someone's bedroom that he's not using. I'm living there. Yeah, anyway, he's not renting it to anyone, right? And that's it.
It's difficult to,
yeah? So look what he says in text 10. This, I just want to add this piece. Say text 10.
Right to refuse. We only compel the property owner not to conduct himself like the inhabitants of Sodom regarding the past. The squatter who resides on his property without paying rent is not compelled to pay him rent for the past. At the same time, it is clear that the property owner has the right to protest the squatter's presence and need not permit the squatter to remain on his property.
Well, in other words, like this. To say that this guy could just come in to your house and you say, no, you can't force. But if the guy did, and you didn't know, and he lived there at least for a month, and then you find out and say, get out. So you can't make him pay for what he was there, but you have a right now to say,
absolutely,
get out. You get the difference?
Yeah.
Why? Also, see, yeah.
I struggle with that because there is no discouragement from squatting, right? So you go away for the summer, your lovely family, and I could be 2 months at your house. I could then find out who else is going on vacation.
And you move into the house.
I could just go from house to house to house, and there's never
breaking
any penalty.
And you can't do it. Legally,
that's
no, what
the squatter
is. No, she wants to understand the Jewish law. But I just want to add the last piece, and then we'll finish and ask the questions. There's one more piece to this, and this is very interesting.
But you heard the other side, because you didn't let him know. So
so this is the thing. The only time I force you to do something, Sodom, is if one person benefits and the other one doesn't lose. So you make them do it because no one is losing and the other one is benefiting. But loss could be two kinds of loss. Listen to this. Loss could be financial. So I'm breaking your house. I'm destroying the, you know, people squat, they could destroy the whole thing. Then there's one more concept of loss in Torah. It's called the loss of control of my property. In other words, when someone comes to my property and I don't have the ownership or the right to control my own property, that's considered a loss for me. Loss is not only financially that there is actual damage or loss to it, but the fact that I can't be my own owner on my own property and control my own lot and decide who's there, and you're infringing on me, that you can't do. That's called a loss. So therefore, the squatter is not going to be charged for what he was there without you knowing about it. But once you know about it, and you tell him to go, then if he doesn't go, he has to pay you rent. He has to pay you everything that he has to pay, because you have a right to decide on your property who's in it, and taking away that right is a damage for me. You get what I'm trying to say? Because it's not only I'm losing financially, that's one kind of loss, but I'm losing my ownership on my house and decide who comes to my property. That's a big loss. This is the last piece. Read the last piece.
Compromise and control. In my opinion, the reason Tosafot rules that the property owner cannot be actively compelled to allow a squatter on his property is because compulsion in such an instance would be a forcible negation of the property owner's control over his own property. Most people would object to this. The failure of an individual to consent to something that most people would object to cannot be considered solemn-like conduct. However, the squatter's presence on the property without the owner's knowledge doesn't negate the owner's control of the property because the owner retains the right to evict the squatter at any time.
So in other words, like this. Could a squatter come into my house when I'm there? Of course, you could say no, because you have a right on your property, because I own it, and I have a right, who could be or not. And if you compel me not, it's infringing and hurting me. So that you can't do. But if someone lived in your property, you didn't know about it, because you were like in Israel for a month, you know, and a guy moves into your property, and then you come and you say, get out, and he got out. Do you make him pay for all the time he was there when you didn't know? That you don't, unless he damaged your property. But if he didn't damage your property, and he didn't hurt your property, so you're not losing, and he's gaining. You got to do it. It sounds funny, but that's...
But is that allowed in Judaism?
No, if the guy's...
Is a squatter committing an avera by...
Okay, you're saying that trespassing on someone else's property?
Yeah, squatting.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Even though I'm not damaging their property, I'm actually like, you know, but I didn't get...
I wouldn't, you know what it is? If you asked me to begin with, should you do it, I would tell you not to. But if someone did it, do I require him to pay rent to the owner of the property? I'm not going to. If the owner still has the right to kick him out, the owner could tell him, go, goodbye. But if he did it without the owner knowing, because the owner wasn't here for 2 months, and he lived in the house and he didn't damage anything, he paid all the electric bills. So what did the owner lose by him living there?
How he get in? From the window?
Whatever, he got in.
From the window, I pay you for the lock.
No.
He
unlocked your door, he had the key, whatever it is.
Okay.
So now, if you take this thinking, let's go to the parking lot. Okay, let's look at the Jewish law. The neighbor went away for a month. On vacation, they went away. And you put your car in the parking lot without asking, right? Is that right to do? No, you should ask. But he didn't ask. Then a month later, the neighbor comes back, says, I want you to pay me a month rent for putting your car in my parking lot. I'm just, according to Jewish civil law, doesn't have to pay if he didn't damage the property. He doesn't have to pay anything. Why? What did the owner lose?
Nothing.
The fact that someone's car is in the lot, what are you losing?
I think the owner gained because it deters...
thieves from coming in, because
exactly.
When they see a car and they see people coming in and out, you're saying it's even a gain,
right?
That the owner has to pay him for putting the car there.
Right,
he should pay him for putting the car. You see that?
Uh-huh.
No, but you understand the point? In this case, but does the owner have a right to say get the car off once he finds out? Yes. Of course he has a right. Why? Because having the right to your ownership of your own property and decide who's there, that is also infringing on my right, according to Torah. So it's not just the loss of money. Even if the parking lot is beautiful and the driveway doesn't damage, I have a right to say, I don't want you on my driveway because I own it and I don't want you. But if the guy used it and it didn't damage you because you were away and then you come back, what did you lose? Nothing. And as she said, it gained. No one came to steal your house. So you didn't lose anything. And that guy gained that he had a parking space for a month. That's Sodom if you're not going to let it happen. Because Sodom means you gain and I don't lose. You got to do it. It sounds a little different than secular law. Now case number Wi-Fi. What's with the Wi-Fi? We didn't end with the Wi-Fi because we're finished. What's Wi-Fi? Wi-Fi, is anyone losing when I use your Wi-Fi without your permission? Do you know about it?
No.
No. Are you losing? Are you losing by me using your Wi-Fi?
No.
So the only thing some people said about the speed... What is it called? The
speed.
That's the only thing that I can think of. Otherwise, if there's no infringement on the speed, and you don't know about it, and And by Wi-Fi, you don't even own Wi-Fi. So that's even a different thing. A house you at least own.
But somebody else is losing.
Who?
The company. Another customer.
Ah.
They need another Wi-Fi.
That's a good point. So you're saying you're stealing from the company.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good point. I'm speaking about, do I have to,
from the friend to the friend,
is he losing? So if the neighbor is not losing, and you're gaining, so if I don't allow it, it's Sodom. Does it make sense?
Yes.
Now, interesting, to end this topic, there was a story, you wouldn't believe it. Someone hired, a true story, he hired workers to move all his barrels of wine from one place to another. He hired them. And they did it, but they were negligent and they broke all the barrels of wine when they were moving. When you don't move the right way. So he said, okay, guys, I'm not paying you for moving. I'm not paying you anything. Go. They said, it wasn't our fault. You know, we tried. It was too heavy. You know, we didn't know how heavy the barrels are. Whatever, don't blame us. So he says, anyways, then later they say, we're poor people. We worked a whole day to carry these barrels of wine. Yes, it broke, but a whole day we were counting on the salary we were going to get at the end of the day. I know we didn't accomplish what you asked for, but we need money for the work we put in. Does he have to pay?
No.
So let's end this story of text 12. Read the story. Rabbi, you ready for this story? Go.
Rabbi Bar Hanan's barrel of wine was negligently broken by the porters he hired to transport it. Rabbi sees the porters' cloaks as payment for the damage. The porters complain to Rav, who instructed Rabbi, give them back their cloaks. Rabbi asked, is that the law? Rav replied, yes, as stated in the verse, in order that you follow the path of the good people. Rabbi returned the porters their cloaks. The porters complained further to Rav, we are poor and we labored all day. Now we are hungry and we have nothing to eat. Rav told Rabbi, pay them their wages. Rabbi asked, is that the law? Rav responded, yes, as stated in the verse, and observe the ways of the righteous.
Let me explain what it means. Halachically, you don't have to pay people that didn't do the job. But what Rav was saying to Rabbah, you're right. But then there is called the ways of Asisa HaTov VaHayasha, meaning you do good beyond good. So yes, these workers were negligent, they didn't, but they worked the whole day. Give them their salary. He paid them. The reason I'm ending off with this is just to teach us how the Torah, the way of law, is with compassion. Of course, by right, they messed up. But they worked. They didn't realize that they can't carry barrels of wine. They didn't estimate their ability. But they did their work. They thought they could do it. So, the fact that the wine broke, it broke. You have to pay them the wages. Just to be good. So you take a grocery store and the delivery guy delivers the food and the bottles break. What are you going to tell the delivery guy? I'm not going to pay you. You pay him for the delivery. The bottles break. Okay, it happens. Anyways, I want to thank you all for joining this first course. I hope you were enlightened of the Jewish way of law. I want to thank David for giving us the secular law, and Matthew. And thank you all for our first course, and hope to see you soon next week. Thank you so much. Yeah, if you're coming back. Keep them. Hopefully you're coming back.
Okay,
thank you. It's five more courses, this book. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you.
This photocopy is only one chapter or the whole thing?
That's one chapter.
That's one, yeah.
Yeah.
Fair, thank you. Thank you, David, for helping
thank
us.
Thank you, Rabbi Shane.
privilege.
There you have the book, right?
Yes.
Rabbi.
Very interesting thing, you know?
I come back from my vacation. Next time I go on vacation, I'm thinking, are they going to come on my driveway?
Okay, that's true. Please.
Deep thoughts.
No, that's good.
Can you sign in and out?
You know, in Hebron, there were squatters after 29 that took over the houses.
Oh, yeah.
Me too.
They're major problems. There are people
I was thinking
that
of that, Norman.
What?
I was thinking of just that, the Hebron.
1929. There are people that
owns the property and.
Half of the people that are there have to share their apartments with the Arabs.
Oh.
Their homes. Crazy.
Yes.
Aren't you?
Thank you, Danny.
Thank you. Thank you.
Come
great
again.
Class. Great class.
That was a good class. It's interesting the difference between regular law and secular law. I mean, secular and religious law. Major difference.
You liked it, Norman, this one?
I liked it. But it's kind of interesting. What I said, unfortunately, was the fact that if you think about Jewish law, all of the items that fall under the umbrella of Jewish law, it's all Be'ahavta le'rachah kamocha.
That's it.
If you follow that, everything falls into place. That's
a good one, no? That's the whole Be'ahavta le'rachah kamocha.
That's what I said.
Spare to you.
Have a good night.
You too.
Good night.
Bless you. See you in the morning.
Please. Early.